Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Professor Amy Jo Levine. She is the author of the book, The Bible With and Without Jesus, which she co-authored with Mark Brettler. A little bit about our guest. A.J. Levine is professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University. She holds a bachelor's from Smith College and an M.A. and Ph.D. from Duke University, along with multiple honorary doctorates from several schools. Her books include The Misunderstood Jew, The Church and the Scandal of the Jewish Jesus, Short Stories by Jesus, The Enigmatic Parables of a Controversial Rabbi, The Meaning of the Bible, What the Jewish Scriptures and the Christian Old Testament Can Teach Us, along with several children's books. So we welcome once again to Common Threads, A.J. Levine. Hi, A.J.
Hi, nice to be back with you.
Thank you. Listen, last week we ended with you talking about some of the things. We were talking about the annotated, the Jewish Annotated New Testament. And you talked about some of the ways that elements in the New Testament can be interpreted as being anti-Semitic, and you offer new opportunities. You look at these stories with a new lens. And for instance, last week we talked about the parable of the Good Samaritan. And I'm going to bet that in that book you also talk about the stereotype of the wrathful God of the Old Testament versus the God of love in the New Testament. And yes, it's true, you can look in the Hebrew Bible, and there is some smiting going on there, but I suspect that it's much, much deeper and more complicated than that. I'd like you to present on that.
Sure. I get that type of thought from a number of my students, and I've heard it from a number of folks in churches where I've worked. I mean, the sad thing is I've sometimes heard that from Jews who are unfamiliar with not only their own Bible, but their own interpretation. When you get this Old Testament God of wrath versus New Testament God of love, it's part of a larger package, which is Old Testament law, New Testament grace, Old Testament failure, New Testament success, and so on. And not only is this unfortunate and inaccurate stereotyping, it's also technically a Christian heresy. It's called Marcionism. It's presuming that the Old Testament God is not the same one as the New Testament God, and that's just silly. Because the God who created the world is the same God to whom Jesus taught his followers to pray, Our Father, same God. When I get that nonsense from my students, I'm inclined to engage in what's called proof texting, which is you just lift up a verse and out of context to make it do what you need it to do. So I say, fine, the Lord is my shepherd who leads me beside still waters and restores my soul, which is Psalm 23. But you are condemned to the outer darkness where there is wailing and gnashing of teeth, which is Jesus. We have Adam and Eve who were threatened with death, but they get to live on for another couple of centuries. Cain is a murderer, but he gets a mark of protection, and he actually manages to find a wife and build a city. We get mercy all over the place. And then you get to the book of Revelation where the world is destroyed 1 1/3 times. So it's cherry-picking, and it's making one type of God look good by making another text God look bad. And it's a very, very nasty game. Another thing that we lose with this is a number of my students and my friends think that if they just look at the Old Testament, I'm using the Christian term here, they understand what Judaism is, without realizing that Judaism, the Judaism of the time of Jesus, the Judaism indeed of today, is not the text, it's the interpretation of the text. And if you look at rabbinic interpretation, they go out of their way not to engage in holy war and not to promote violence and to contextualize those more problematic passages.
You know, it's interesting when we talk about this particular issue, the Old Testament God versus New Testament God, it reminds me of the one woman show that Julia Sweeney did. Have you ever seen that from Saturday Night Live? She's an alum.
I remember Julia Sweeney, but I don't know the one-woman show.
Okay. It is a one-woman show where she offers her spiritual journey from Catholicism to atheism. And in that, she talks about one day just deciding to read the Bible. And when she is reading the Hebrew portion of the Bible, she is seeing, her interpretation is this somewhat wrathful, spiteful deity. And she keeps saying, oh, once I get to the New Testament, everything's going to be fine. And she finds out that it isn't. And that is one thing that led her to become an atheist. So she sees the similar things that you see. Unfortunately, she did not have, I shouldn't say unfortunately, it's her spiritual path. She can go where she needs to. But she did not have the context that you have to see that that ain't necessarily so in either case. So
belief in God, right, but belief in God is really not something that, that should be argued by an intellectual adventure of sorts, because it's not logical. Belief in God is not like Sudoku, right? If you just had a pencil and an eraser, everybody could get the right answer. Belief in God is like love, and love has nothing to do with logic. It's something that speaks to your heart. Where the academics comes in is once you got the belief, then you can backtrack and say, well, let me make my belief stronger by reading these texts, which were written by other believers who had these particular views. And then you can put those into dialogue. Like you fall in love, then you go to marriage counseling to make it stronger. But if there's no belief that's there to begin with, or if the belief is really shaky, the Bible could take you farther into belief or it can take you out of it. But that's where your heart is inclined anyway.
Good point. I certainly agree. You brought up last week, you brought up proof texting. That is a term that I've not heard before, but I've experienced millions of times. And you make a case fur and again in the book. When is proof texting appropriate and when does it get you into trouble?
It depends upon who your audience is. if you want to make a point and you have a text that will support your point, then you cite your particular text. And sometimes you will yank it out of context. But we do that all the time because certain verses speak to us and other verses don't. So you can make a wonderful argument by yanking a text out of context and redeploying it elsewhere. That's, in fact, what the New Testament frequently does when it cites from, quote unquote, the Old Testament, again, using the Christian term. So it's reading the Greek translation of Isaiah about a virgin conceiving, and then Matthew goes, oh, yes, I can attach that to the Christ. That helps me explain the conception of Jesus. We see people like the Dead Sea Scrolls. They take what the prophet Habakkuk says or the prophet Nahum, and they says, oh, it really means not their own time centuries ago. It's really speaking to our time today. We're always doing that. Anybody who opens the Bible to get a particular message for that day, that's proof texting. And it works. I mean, God forbid you'd open to Job. You want to open to a psalm or something like that. Or Song of Songs would be great. But you're always taking we're always taking texts out of context because, in part, people who look to the Bible for inspiration or for the divine word, that word has to mean something to them in their own present circumstances. It can't just be an historical artifact.
Tell me, how far back does the tradition of the synagogue go? So the synagogue and the temple coexisted, right?
Correct.
Okay. Do we know how far back the synagogue goes? And what was the difference between the synagogue and the temple? Was the temple purely for sacrifice and you didn't get any spiritual education there? For there you had to go to the synagogue? Is that too simplistic?
That's too simplistic. as much of the stuff that we have in biblical studies is, right? It's hard to reduce it. The temple is, there were, way back in ancient Israel, there were lots of places where you could do sacrifices, which is how, say, the prophet Elijah gets to sacrifice on Mount Carmel, for example, or Abraham can offer a sacrifice. But eventually, under King Josiah in the late 7th century, which means the 600s BCE, Josiah basically centralized sacrificial worship in Jerusalem. So the temple becomes the place where you offer animal sacrifices, but it's also the place where you would go for pilgrimage, the tradition of singing the Hallel Psalms as you came up to Jerusalem. You always go up to Jerusalem, right? You could be on the moon, you go up to Jerusalem. It's also a place of prayer. It's a place of instruction, which is, we, for example, see Jesus teaching in the temple, and he would not have been the only one. It's a place for family reunions. It's a place where you could celebrate the majesty of God. And at the time of Jesus, you could celebrate, God, we're Jews. We've got this fabulous building. This looks great. Because when King Herod the Great redid the temple, it's massive reconstruction, he built it in part as a tourist attraction. So even Gentiles would come and go, wow, great temple. So it becomes a site also of Jewish ethnic pride and Jewish resistance to assimilation to the broader concerns of the Roman Empire. It's the National Bank. It's a place where you could make donations to the poor, knowing that those funds would be appropriately redistributed. So it's a huge number of different things. Synagogues, it's a Greek term. Syn, like synapse or synthesis, just means to come together. And ago means to gather. So it's basically a gathering place, a place where people come together. Or think of like a fellowship hall or a vestry. So it's a place of prayer. It's a place where the Torah was read and discussed and interpreted. It's a place where people gathered for social concerns. But it's not a place where you sacrifice animals. It's not a place of sacrifice. So the temple and the synagogue have very different concerns. Most Jews would have only gone to the temple during pilgrimage festivals, you know, unless you lived in Jerusalem and wanted to go there. Some may have only gone once. Some may never have gone in their lives. But synagogues are all over the place.
They were outside of Palestine back then?
We've got examples of synagogues in Dura Europis, on the island of Delos. The book of Acts talks about Paul visiting various synagogues in the Eastern diaspora and then moving west. Synagogues in Rome. So yeah, okay. And when you have Jews, you have synagogues.
No.
Because it's really hard to be a Jew just by yourself. You kind of want to be a Jew in community.
Yeah, I've heard that that's virtually impossible.
It's very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I was told that as a Jew, you go to a new place, you're pretty much required to find other Jews. I mean, that's just that's what
it's
somebody
a
told
good
me.
Idea.
Yeah, yeah,
it's a good idea.
So, do you think the Bible would have survived all this time if the meaning, if the all of these things that we're talking about, all of these things that seem on one level contradictory, if the Bible was absolutely clear, how do you think it would have survived in these thousands of years?
I don't think any text is absolutely clear. the Bible is not just law, and law requires interpretation. So if somebody says don't kill, then you have to figure out, well, what about self-defense, and what about if it's armed conflict, and can you pull the plug on somebody if the person is brain dead but the organs are still living? So you always have to have interpretation of this material. Don't steal. Well, you know, what if you're starving? Is it okay to rob somebody who's robbed from you? What counts as stealing? Is inheritance stealing and so on? So we always need interpretation. And anytime you have a story, whether it's Adam and Eve or the story of King David, which already in the Bible is told in different ways between the Deuteronomic historian who gives us 1st and 2nd Samuel and the chronicler, stories are always open to multiple interpretations. That's why English teachers still have jobs. That's why people still teach law. Nothing is perfectly clear. And even if you say, well, AJ, it is, you know, God so loved the world that he gave his only son. Well, then the next question is, well, why did that have to happen? And how exactly did it work? So even things that are clear, people will still raise questions.
Good point.
And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
A very good thing.
I remember a story, the true story, that there was a Buddhist Catholic dialogue. So you had these monks and priests, and they were observing one another's scriptures. And the Catholics looked at the Buddhist scriptures, and they found multiple contradictions in question. How can you have so many apparent contradictions? And the response from one of the Buddhist teachers was, well, that makes it much harder to become dogmatic, doesn't it?
So. That's very nice.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today is Dr. Amy Jill Levine, and we're talking about the book that she co-authored with Mark Brettler, which is the Bible with and without Jesus. Tell us about what is the Pesher and why is it important?
Pesher is biblical interpretation. It's a genre that we begin to find quite clearly among the Dead Sea Scrolls, and some of them are actually named Pesher, like the Pesher to Habakkuk or the Pesher to Nahum. And there are attempts to show how ancient prophecy is fulfilled during the time of the person who's writing the Pesher. So it would be similar to you pick up a biblical text today and you say, oh, Isaiah is speaking directly to me today in my own circumstances. This was the word that God wanted me to hear today. That would be a Pesher interpretation.
And
that's okay.
What's
because
that?
Otherwise, we need something like that, because otherwise the text remains an historical artifact that cannot speak through the generations.
That does make sense. Talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls, does Jesus or John the Baptist appear there? Or is that?
Nope. Nope. Or at least, as some of my friends say, not yet. Maybe they'll still find one, but no.
Does it happen? You take part in a number of interfaith panels, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Does it happen that you are in panels that go beyond, say, Jews, Christians? Do you sometimes dialogue with Muslims? And when you dialogue with Muslims, are you studied enough in the Quran to be able to dialogue about the stories that appear in the Hebrew Bible and also have a version in the Quran? And I'm curious,
right,
as to what the outcome may be often. I'm assuming that you have different outcomes at different panels and different dialogues, but if you could share a little bit on that, I'd be curious.
Sure. I haven't done a number of trialogues, that would be the technical term, or the so-called Abrahamic faith conversations. Recently, when I have, they've usually been focused on a particular theme. So you don't have to have, I did not have to have complete knowledge of both the Quran and the Hadith and the rest of the Islamic tradition in order to participate. I can tell you what normally happened is the Jews and the Muslims landed on one side of the table and the Christians landed on the other side of the table because the Trinity proved to be a stumbling block. Jews and Muslims have a legal-based religious tradition with certain ritual actions that in which everybody practicing Muslims and Jews engage, and Christians much less so. So Jews and Muslims technically have more in common, although Jesus and Mary do show up in Muslim writings. I stopped doing that for the most part because I felt uncomfortable trying to talk about a religion in which I cannot read the material in the original. And the more I work in Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek, the more important I find that primary source work to be, because all translations are traitors anyway. And since I cannot read Arabic, which was my fault when my graduate professor said, you know, after you've done the Greek and the Hebrew and the Aramaic and the Latin and the Syriac and the Coptic and the French and the German and the smattering of Italian you need, it's time to learn Arabic. And I said, no, it's not, because I didn't think I could stuff another language into my brain. So I can't read Arabic, and therefore I'm not quite qualified fully to participate in a trialogue agenda, because I can't read the sources in the originals.
So when you read any translation of either the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament, does it frustrate you thinking, oh gosh, this poor uneducated person, I mean, he may have a PhD in computer science, but this person who is not able to really see the language as I do it is not getting what he or she should get out of this passage. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I would flip the question around and say, I'm just glad the person's reading the passage to begin with. That's a start. But there are a number of annotated Bibles, like the Jewish Annotated Bible, New Testament, or the Jewish Study Bible, that provide in the notes alternative translations where they are particularly important. And there are some translators, Robert Alter's new translation of the Hebrew Bible, for example, where he's very, very sensitive to the puns that Hebrew contains.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that they're there, but I've never been exposed to them. Maybe one or two along the line, but That is one I would enjoy.
Well, as we talked about last week, you can play with wind and breath and spirit. It's a marvelous pun.
Speaking of which, that goes back to when we were talking about Adam and Eve. So in these last few minutes, why don't we talk about, because this is, of course, very foundational, the Jewish interpretation of the story of the paradise and the fall and the Christian understanding of the paradise and the fall and how everything ended up for both religions.
I have to rephrase your question again, because Jews don't have a notion of a fall. With fall here meaning some sort of irreparable breach between humanity and divinity that only the death of the Christ can resolve. And there's also more than one Jewish reading. So as soon as you say the Jewish reading, some other Jew's going to come around and say, yeah, but what about so-and-so and so-and-so? So Jews actually glory in multiple readings. When Christians are reading the Old Testament, again, using the Christian term, most of that is not multiple. Most of it is just driving to the Christ. So Jews is kind of like an original opportunity. God said, don't eat the fruit. They ate the fruit. They don't drop dead. They live for another couple of hundred years. When they exit Eden, God goes with them. And the first thing he does is get pregnant, which strikes me as highly optimistic. And God remains with the people, I mean, through Noah and to Abraham and so on through the covenant community. So part of this is that Adam and Eve, after the first couple of chapters of Genesis, they don't show up again in the Tanakh, in the Jewish scriptures. But when you get to the New Testament, they start showing up again. So in Paul's epistle to the Romans, chapter 5, he talks about through one man, meaning Adam, sin comes into the world and therefore death, so that through another man, meaning the Christ, meaning Jesus, life can come back and grace can re-enter. When you get up to 1 Timothy, a letter ascribed to Paul in the New Testament, 1 Timothy announces, the man, meaning Adam, was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. So now you start getting this blame put on Eve and questions about how men and women are supposed to be in terms of, equality versus superior subordinate status. So because Adam and Eve reappear in the New Testament, they're more important in Christianity than they are in Judaism. Judaism is much more interested in Torah from Moses.
And one other thing that you say in the book, you say that, and I don't have the quote right in front of me, but you indicate that to Jews, the scripture is not as important as the interpretation. And in Christianity, it's the scripture. But how can scripture not be interpreted? What are the Jews doing?
Right?
Well, what are the Jews doing?
Right, it's always interpreting, right? So the quote is not entirely accurate. Some Christians have a very strong interpretive history, and you see that in Eastern Orthodoxy. You see it in the Roman Catholic Church with developed material, say, on the Virgin Mary, or questions of canon law in the magisterium. But there was a drive with Martin Luther and some of the Protestant reformers. Luther had this motto of sola scriptura, so going back to the scripture and getting rid of all that what he considered to be unnecessary accretions that Jews had put on via the Talmud and that Catholics had put on via later Catholic legal systems and doctrinal developments. So it's a kind of Protestant view that says just go back, and what the text means is what you personally, you the individual reader, get from it.
What is your next project, AJ? Can you give us a sneak preview?
I'm right now trying to finish up a book for Abingdon Press on the difficult sayings of Jesus, like comments about hell, to the comment in John chapter 8 about the Jews, you're children of the devil, statements about sell all you have and give to the poor, questions about you have to hate your family. So what did these statements mean in their own context? How have they been interpreted over time? And I'm having lots of fun writing it because these are really juicy passages. And then I've got another big book I want to write on Jesus in draft for Harper, who's our publisher for the Bible With and Without Jesus. And it's not a what would Jesus do book, because I don't think that's a helpful question. Jesus doesn't live in a participatory democracy in the 21st century, but rather, how do stories Jesus told like parables and stories told about Jesus like the healing narratives, how do they help us think through contemporary problems? And that's that sense of how the Bible continues to speak to us and how an ancient text still provides instruction, not necessarily to give us the right answer, but rather to help us ask the right questions. And asking the right questions, I think, can help us today refocus some of our energies from just spinning out of control or going down those echo chambers, and engaging us better in speaking to people with whom we might have some sort of disagreement to say, what is the common good that we are striving for?
I'm glad you explained that first one, the difficult sayings of Jesus. I was assuming you were talking about difficult to pronounce Aramaic words, but that's not it at all, is it?
I have no problem with pronouncing Aramaic words. Thank you very much.
AJ, it has been a wonderful conversation today and last week as well. I want to thank you so much for being with us, sharing your time.
You are just a joy of an interviewer. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Mom.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate you too as well, AJ. So we have been speaking with Professor AJ Levine, and her book is The Bible With and Without Jesus. It's co-authored with Mark Brettler. Please join us again next week here on WGVU.